This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Today on the show, a man who needs no introduction. Billion Dollar Whale, the book he co-authored with Bradley Hope, was an instant bestseller here in Malaysia. And the work that both of them have done at the Wall Street Journal over the last 3 years have been absolutely instrumental in shedding light on what has been arguably the biggest financial scandal in the history of the world. Tom Wright, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Hello.
Now, I know many of you are keen to ask your questions. I'll do my best to get them to Tom in the time that we have with him. So you can send us your thoughts at 018-789-8899 or on Twitter. We're at BFM Radio. Tom, congratulations to you and Bradley on the book. Now, it's been hailed by many as a masterpiece in investigative journalism. But Tom, I have to admit to you that personally, I found it to be a very difficult read. I wasn't transported from reality as I would have been with any other book. I wasn't living vicariously through the characters of these books. I was upset and I was angry. And I was angry that this had happened to us. And I think I wanted to ask you, I wanted to begin our conversation there, that this book was initially meant for an international audience. How have you dealt with the Malaysian response to it?
That's a great question. I mean, on Twitter and on Instagram, and I've been amazed by the anger, actually, of Malaysians. Obviously, I'm not Malaysian. And we did write this with an international audience and a Malaysian audience in mind. You know, we want to sell this around the world and educate people about the sort of the enablers in the global financial system. But yeah, I was actually taken aback by people saying, look, I had to stop at this chapter because I was spewing or, you know, I found this. And it's been great to see what people have picked out from the book. Mm. You know, there was somebody on Twitter yesterday saying, oh, I love this, the fact that the documents that we were leaked had this password protection, Save Malaysia. And someone said they were actually crying reading that. So it made me realize this isn't just a book. This is something that's sort of riding a wave in Malaysia that's to do with this sort of democratization of Malaysia. Mm. And that's been fantastic.
Well, let's start at the beginning then. Now that the journal, it started to look into 1MDB, I think it was back in 2013 when it started. Why at that time was the journal paying so much attention, so close attention to a Malaysian sovereign wealth fund?
Well, it was, I mean, back in 2013, it was very, well, a reporter of ours who covers Wall Street had lunch with Gary Cohen, who was president of Goldman. And he was basically showing off at the time about the profits that Goldman were making in Malaysia. And it struck the reporter as strange because why would a big Wall Street bank be making, you know, $600 million in profits out of Malaysia, which is, you know, frankly, a very insignificant market. It should not be the case. And so back then, that was around the election time. My colleagues Alex Frangos and Matt Wirtz wrote about this, and the story at the time didn't really uncover what was going on. It was more that this just didn't make any sense.
Right.
And it also referred to the Sarawak bonds that Goldman had done, which also was very strange. Why would a big Wall Street bank be doing bonds for Sarawak? But it was at that point, it was really a lot of questions that were unanswered rather than, you know, any narrative.
And what was your entry point into the story?
So and then, of course, Claire Rucastle-Brown broke the story in February of 2015 with the PetroSaudi emails and the whole Joe Lowe's receipt of the $700 million. Mm-hmm. And we wrote a big front page story about the use of 1MDB as a slush fund by Najib, which we really detailed how 1MDB had overpaid for power plants, and then in return Tanjong and Genting had paid these massive amounts of money into Yayasan 1MDB, and again that just didn't make any sense. And around that time, we were very lucky with timing because around that time, there were people in the Malaysian government who were investigating Najib and the money that he received into his accounts. And they were looking to leak the information. But basically a week after we had that front page story, we were leaked the information about Najib's account.
So at what point of the series of, transactions that weren't making sense, at what point did you realize that you had a great story on your hand? Because I'm sure it just started off as data points that, oh, that doesn't make sense and this raises eyebrows. At what point do you realize, well, I've got this great story in my hands now?
Well, I think in the summer of 2015, obviously, when you've got news that a sitting prime minister, one who's been courted by Obama in the US, took $681 million, that's a good story.
Right.
But basically, it's been 3 years of very, very hard work to find out exactly what happened, because back then it seemed that, the New York Times also had a story about Jolo buying the Time Warner penthouse, mm-hmm. right? And it seemed that Jolo was a bagman for Najib back then, which is pretty typical in emerging markets. You have these figures who carry the water for the politicians, right? What we were able to learn reporting this book was that Jolo was not nobody's bagman, And, Shafi recently has been saying that our book shows that Najib didn't do anything wrong. Well, that's not right. I mean, Najib took a lot of money into his personal accounts. But I think what he's getting at is that our book shows that probably Jolo is the only person who had a 360-degree view of what was going on here. I don't think Najib knew that Jolo was siphoning, $4.5 billion or more out of the fund. He just knew that he had this political slush fund that, his wife was getting jewels, but I don't think they really knew the scope of it.
Or didn't question where it came from.
Correct. And it was, to your question, when did we realize we had a great story? It was when we started to sort of piece it together from, multiple documents, WhatsApp chats, interviews with people, triangulating all the different investigations that were going on around the world, that Jolo was really at the center, at the heart of it. And he knew everything that was going on.
Did you feel at any point in this investigation that you and Bradley were risking your careers?
No, it was good for our careers.
but at any point in the 3 years, I'm sure that before the story materialized and you knew that you had this, the world's biggest financial scandal, did you feel that you were risking your careers, investigating, poking holes, asking questions, perhaps to people that they didn't want you to ask questions to?
What do you mean, the idea that we may have gotten sued or into some kind of legal trouble? I mean, at the beginning, it was very difficult to cover this story because we were lawyered. The Wall Street Journal has extremely high standards. If you read something in the Wall Street Journal, you know that it's true. Mm. The amount of sleepless nights I had dealing with our lawyers and our vetters, God bless them. But, and things have gotten easier as we've progressed the story over 3 years. Now it's much more obvious to us what happened. And so it's much easier to state the story. But back then we had like small windows onto things, from various documents. And it was much harder to give the full picture.
Your remark about it's benefited your career, Tom, your critics have argued that you're commercializing or cashing in on a scandal that has financially and politically wounded a country. How would you respond to the critics who claim that you're milking the 1MDB cow for your own benefit?
I think there's only one yardstick in journalism, right? And I'm sure you agree to this. You're a journalist. It's true or it's not true, right? And everything we've reported is true. So when we would get criticized by, UMNO politicians or whomever, I mean, my response is always, well, is it true or isn't it not true? Mm. And that's all that matters, right? So, for example, Najib said that the money was a Saudi donation. The documents show that was not true, right? It came from a British Virgin Islands company that was funded by 1MDB. And that's laid out by the Department of Justice in its lawsuits.
And what's your end game with this? Did you and Bradley write it with an end game in mind? What did you hope to achieve with it?
I think what we hope to achieve with this book is to show that what happened here obviously for you guys, it's a Malaysian story, but this is a global story, right? I mean, what happened here was Jolo, behind the scenes, ran a sovereign wealth fund and was able to raise $6.5 billion at the drop of a hat with the help of Goldman. He was able to move it, and every single actor in the global financial system failed to do their job, from auditors to Swiss banks to Wall Street banks, to law firms. I mean, he moved, hundreds of millions of dollars via Sherman Sterling, a white shoe law firm in New York City. So the book is an attempt to show, where we're at in the 21st century with capitalism, and it's a true crime thriller.
That was precisely what I thought, because, you know, my question is, your book reads like a true crime novel. Was that intentional? Did you write that book intentionally in that way? Because if you look at the other books on 1MDB published recently, they have very different treatments of the subject matter.
So what we did was we identified all the scenes that we could muster, right? Whether it's Leonardo DiCaprio and Jolo in a suite in a Las Vegas hotel with 22 playmates.
So you wanted it to be descriptive.
Yes, exactly. I mean, no one's going to read a book about money flows. And I think one of the problems with, you know, the Panama Papers or books of that nature, it's just so boring to read about corruption, right? The journal, 10 years ago, I remember an editor telling me, I don't want to read corruption stories.
Yeah, so that's
money flow stories.
That's very much in line, I think, with the way the journal reports, right? Even on the most complex of business or finance news, it's always involved this singular question, that is, what is the emotional center of this story? So for all the technical and financial complexities that's behind all the 1MDB transactions, Tom, what is the emotional center of this story?
I think the emotional center of the story is, well, it's a biography of Jolo, one of the world's most fascinating characters, if you ask me, right? And it's also a story about what can you buy with money, right? What does hundreds of millions of dollars buy you? You know, well, anything. It gets you friendships with Leonardo DiCaprio. It allows you to date Miranda Kerr. You can mix with Martin Scorsese at his 70th birthday party in New York City. There's literally no end to what you can do. You can bypass all compliance at banks. Right, you try to move $10,000 out of Malaysia, you'd be filling forms until your head bursts, right?
That's right.
Jolo controlled a Swiss bank, right? So it's really about how the 0.1% or the 0.01% operate. And they operate outside the rules of normal human behavior.
I'm speaking to Tom Wright, one half of the duo behind The Billion Dollar Whale. After this, we're going to take a look at some of the main players in this stranger than fiction conspiracy. Keep it here on The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris. Speaking with me today is the investigative journalist and Pulitzer finalist Tom Wright. He's one half of the duo behind the best-selling and most sought-after book in Malaysia right now, Billion Dollar Whale. Now, if you have a specific question you'd like Tom to address, you can send them my way. It's 018-789-8899, or you can tweet me at BFM Radio. So, Tom, let's focus now on the various actors in this play. Let's kick it off with Jolo, of course. The book reads very differently from the reporting that you did at the Journal. In many ways, it's a detailed profile of Jolo and the role that he played in orchestrating what was arguably the biggest financial fraud in history of the world. The thing is, Tom, we never actually hear from Jolo himself. So do you think his voice was unimportant in telling this story?
I actually got a very similar comment from one of my friends who read this very early on.
Right.
And one of the problems we had was trying to actually find interesting things that he had to say. Everyone who met him said, oh, he's lovely, nice guy, very generous, meaning he'd given them something, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's $25,000 or $250,000 in gambling chips or a Cartier watch or, you know, you just got drunk on Cristal all night and you didn't have to spend any money, right? That was a kind of... But when it came to sort of getting something substantive about him from people who'd met him, that was more tricky. And it's almost like this guy's glacial cold, right? Very, very nice and making sure you get what you want, but not somebody who really opens up. And there's a scene in the book where a friend of his who's partying with him in Saint-Tropez says, look, it just felt like we were doing this for show, right?
Why?
And you might get the sense, if you've read this book, that actually these parties don't seem a lot of fun. Right? Like people are turning up at these things and shouting Malaysia in the house and Paris Hilton's there. But it's all sort of done for show. And I think Jolo is somebody who has this internal life that's very hard to penetrate.
Do you feel that after doing so much reporting on him that you've come to understand him on some level, to understand what motivates him?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I feel like he's not somebody who would have the normal run of human emotions like you or I. There's something driving this guy that makes him an extremely interesting character, but it's not something that's easily relatable for us. I mean, he's, for example, you know, he takes money through. We have the first fraud, the second fraud, and the third fraud. And even after he is found out and people start reporting about him and he's named in a Department of Justice civil lawsuit in the summer of 2016, he just keeps going. You know, and in The Great Gatsby, Nick Carraway says of Gatsby, he's one of the most optimistic people I ever knew. That's true of Joe Lo. He's somebody who has such a high tolerance for risk, you know?
So I have to ask, is he a financial genius? I mean, how did you come to terms with the fact that this man in his 20s had successfully raided the international finance system for billions of dollars?
I don't think he's a financial genius. Someone I know very well, a Malaysian who will remain nameless and helped a lot with this book, said that the thing that he did that was so amazing about Joe Lo was he was always able to go into a room, see who was powerful, work out how that person could help him, and connect that person to another powerful person and put himself in the mix. That was really his genius. So when he first sort of burst onto the scene here in Malaysia after Wharton, he's able to connect Middle Eastern investors with then Deputy Prime Minister Najib Razak. And he brings in Mubadala, this Middle Eastern fund, to invest in the Johor Iskander project. He does things like that over and over again. You know, even when he is exiled from Malaysia by Najib in 2015, he goes to China and he persuades CEOs of state-owned companies to invest in you know, the East Coast Rail deal. He never gives up. Even now, you know, he is texting and sending messages into the new Malaysian government saying, look, I'll help you with, you know, your meetings, Mahathir's meetings in New York this week. Or I'll help you with, you know, getting the assets back. You'll never get these assets back if you don't include me. Most people, you or I, I'm sure we would have given up and we'd give ourselves in, right?
You're still getting texts, you're still getting information about this in recent days?
Yeah, I mean, this is a live story. This is another amazing thing about this story. I mean, most times that people write a nonfiction book, it's a historical thing.
This
right?
doesn't end with the book.
No, the paperback will be the definitive version in a year right now. I mean, this is something that makes it such a sexy story, right? I mean, it's still playing out. Obviously, Jolo's in China. He's protected because Chinese authorities, he knows something about somebody in China who was involved in those infrastructure deals in Malaysia. And doesn't seem like Malaysian government is having any success in getting China to send him back.
How close were you or Bradley to getting direct access to Joe Lo?
Well, you know, we tried to get him to talk to us over and over again. We gave him, you know, over 3 years, not just for the book, you know, but also for the Wall Street Journal. We gave him ample opportunity to talk, and he didn't take it. What he wanted to do was to challenge the book, right? Mm-hmm. To use his lawyers in the UK and in the US, Shillings and Cobry and Kim, to send, I guess, hundreds of legal letters to independent bookstores and to retailers, threatening that if they hold the book, they could be the subject of a defamation case. But we have not had a substantive answer to any of our questions from him.
Would be that one burning question that you and Bradley are dying to ask him if you had access to him?
Why did you do it? Right? I mean, you were from a family in Penang that was worth millions of dollars. You went to Harrow. You're a smart guy, right? You went to Wharton. You could have used those networking skills I referred to earlier to have a very successful career in finance, I think. And the other question I would ask is, why did you not stop? When you had taken, you know, there are allegations that he's taken $4.5 billion, why did you not start to fill the hole? Why did you keep on going? And there's a crazy part of the book where there's a loan from Deutsche Bank, and instead of using that loan, if you remember, this is a time when everyone in Malaysia, The Edge and others are saying, look, bring this money back from the Caymans, where is it? Mm-hmm. And instead of filling that hole, he goes and buys the Equanimity. So it's almost as if he believed that, you know, with the political cover of Najib, he could just write off this money. And that, to me, is a crazy thing. So I would ask him about that for sure.
Until May 9th happened, of course, right? So the latest Rout report is now saying that Joe Lo's lawyers have approached the DOJ hoping to strike a deal. What do you think the game plan is here for Joe Lo?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think the DOJ is going to strike a deal with them over that. I mean, that seems like a very speculative report to me. I mean, think about it. If you're the center of a fraud, how do you plea bargain, right?
Sell out the other side.
Yeah, but it's not as if the DOJ is going to say, hey, Joe Lo, we're going to cut you a deal here. You can't do that. I mean, this guy's at the center of the fraud. No, that's not going to happen.
Well, let's talk about some other people who are part of this scandal. We talk about Dato' Sri Najib Razak and Dato' Sri Rosmahman. So I'd like to start with some of the responses that your book has received since its release. Now, Najib's lawyer, Shafi'i Abdullah, claimed at a press conference recently that your book exculpates Najib from any wrongdoing. That it was, in fact, Jolo who misled the former prime minister. How would you respond to that claim?
It's nonsense. I mean, clearly Shafi hasn't read the book very closely. That's what I'd say for sure.
Maybe he didn't get a copy.
Have you read the book?
I have.
Do you think it's true?
No.
There you go. I mean, basically what he's trying to do is we are fair to Najib in the book. And we're fair to everyone. And I think what we say is that Najib did not know the full, and I said this earlier in the interview, right? He did not know the full import of what was going on. Only Jolo knew that. So did Najib know that 4.5 billion or more was taken from the Malaysian people? Probably not. But he did know it was a slush fund, and he did know that you know, there were all these assets getting purchased, including a Belgravia house that Najib and Rosma would stay in, you know, all of Riz's places in the US, the film company, the $27 million jewel that Rosma got, right? And by the way, I'd like to address something else. They keep saying that they gave the money back, right? Najib keeps saying it was a Saudi donation and the money went back. The money went back into an offshore company called Tanor, right? It didn't go back to the Saudis. It didn't come from the Saudis. The money came from 1MDB via Tanor. It went back to Tanor. And from there, it was used to buy the $27 million jewel for Rosma.
Where does Rosma come in? How much of a player was she in this whole scandal?
Well, she's sort of like Jolo's entry point, right? Because, well, there are two kind of fascinating characters who are the entry points. There's Rosma, and there's also this guy, Yusuf Al-Otaiber, who's the UAE ambassador to the US. Al-Otaiber is somebody, he's still the ambassador, and he allows Jolo to get to know all these powerful Middle Eastern people. And then Rosma is obviously Jolo's entry to Najib, because it was her son, Riza Aziz, that Jolo knew when he lived in when he was at Harrow and Riza was at LSE. And so Rosma is important because she, I believe, helps Jolo get to the center of power in Malaysia. And then, of course, she benefits from this because suddenly she's getting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of jewelry and other assets through this connection.
Well, you know, Jolo seems to be the only person, as you mentioned, who has this 360-degree view of everything that took place within 1MDB. But you said a little earlier, he's nobody's bagman. Right? So is he the silver bullet in solving this, the 1MDB saga?
Yeah. I mean, if you got Jolo and he told you everything that happened, then you would know. But I think we've got a pretty good picture of what happened.
Without him?
Yeah. I don't think he was that careful at covering his tracks. You know, you asked earlier, is he a financial genius? I think he's got, you know, huge, you know, his ability to take risks is huge. But I don't think he really spent a lot of time making sure that nobody could unravel this. I mean, the investigators we've talked to said that it's actually not that difficult to find out what happened if you start looking at the money trails.
So from everything that you've written, Tom, you and Bradley, I can't help but come to the conclusion that 1MDB was never really meant to serve the Malaysian public. It felt like it was just a political and personal slush fund to serve the excesses of a small group of people. Do you think that is an accurate assessment?
Very accurate. I think it's extremely brazen. I mean, one of the larger contexts we try to paint in the book is this idea that there are all these kleptocratic governments around the world who see these pots of money as personal piggy banks. You know, back in the 80s with Marcos or with Sani Abacha in Nigeria, the amounts of money were lower, right? The 1,000 shoes that Imelda Marcos got, it almost seems quaint versus, you know, what got hauled out of the Pavilion Apartments the other day, right? And the reason is that there's so much liquidity on world financial markets. So they're able to raise billions of dollars at the drop of a hat and just take it.
So in the book, you talked about the tragic murder of Kevin Moraes. Do you believe that his killing was the direct result of him working on Najib's charge sheet?
I think it's that we need more investigations to find out exactly what happened. I mean, we put it in the book in a very sort of neutral way. I mean, our reporting shows that he was involved in drawing up the draft charges against Najib, for sure. And then there seems to be a bunch of problems with the ongoing case into his murder, I mean, that's still playing out, right, that case. And we'll see whether the judge, how the judge rules on whether, you know, Moraes was killed in connection with this army, it's an army surgeon, right? I mean, it definitely looks and smells suspicious.
I'm speaking to Tom Wright, co-author of The Billion Dollar Whale. Now, we're going to continue our conversation with Tom just after the 8:30 news bulletin, and I'm sure you don't want to miss it. So stay with us on The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with The Breakfast Grill. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation with Tom Wright, Pulitzer finalist and co-author of The Billion Dollar Whale. Now, you write in your book that this is a scandal that implicates more than just Joe Low and the former prime minister. It's really about a story of global corruption and how, as you mentioned earlier, just before the news, that if you have enough money, you know, the normal checks and balances don't apply if you're moving money within the global financial system. How culpable do you think Goldman Sachs is in this 1MDB scandal?
Well, there's two things going on right now. There is a... Regulators in the US are looking into whether Goldman Sachs missed red flags, right? So, for example, 1MDB asked Goldman Sachs, after Goldman Sachs had raised the money for them, to put $3 billion into this Swiss bank BSI. Why would a sovereign wealth fund need a Swiss bank account? Why do you open a Swiss bank account? You do so because you want to hide money from the tax man, right? So why did 1MDB have a Swiss bank account? It could have had a bank account with CIMB or any of the Malaysian banks. Didn't make sense. Mm. So that's the kind of red flag and by the way, Goldman's lawyer on that transaction, Linklaters in Singapore, the lawyer who was telling Goldman what you know the risks were, said that transaction was dodgy, and they went ahead anyway. And they said, well, there were no BSI, the bank the money was put into, was not on any money laundering list, and that was their defense. But regulators in the US are going to look at all of this, and they're going to say, well, did Goldman miss red flags? And they could get fined under the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. That was the same act that was used to fine JP Morgan, where Bernie Madoff had his accounts. So the idea is, if you're a big Wall Street bank, you have to make sure that you're self-policing, right, and not allowing money launderers to move money around. So there's that. But there's also an ongoing criminal investigation. So that would be a civil fine without necessarily admitting wrongdoing. There's also an ongoing criminal investigation that the DOJ is running from the Eastern District of New York, the Brooklyn prosecutor, that is looking at Goldman's role and is looking at Tim Leissner's role. And Tim Leissner is in plea bargain talks with the Department of Justice, which means that he is either cooperating or he's going to admit to some kind of wrongdoing.
All right. So if it's just a civil fine, then, you know, and no admission of guilt, Tom, then nothing really changes, right? It's just a slap on the wrist. Then it just becomes an operational cost for banks like these.
Yeah, correct. I mean, our book has this quote from Jesse Eisinger, right, who wrote this book last year called The Chicken Shit Club. And the book is a great book. And it's all about how there's this revolving door at the Department of Justice, right? People work for the big banks, then they go and work for the Department of Justice, then they go and work for the big banks. And so white-collar crime does not get prosecuted in the way that it should. And since the financial crisis, the subprime crisis, really no bankers have been prosecuted for their role in that. And we make the point that, you know, back in the 90s, 80s and 90s, in the savings and loan crisis in America, 1,000 bankers were charged. Mm. So... really, what's so exciting about this is what will happen now as investigators in America look at what happened in the 1MDB case. Will bankers be held to account or not?
Yes, do you think that if the criminal investigation does materialize, do you think this could be a tipping point in the way things are done differently within the global financial system?
It could be. But, you know, Jesse Eisinger, who I talked to about this, doesn't think so. And, you know, there are some sites, like, for example... Volkswagen executives have been charged, right, for the emissions scandal. So there are some signs that executives are being held to account for wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing in that case. But if you're a cynic, you would say probably Goldman will pay some fine and potentially reach what's called a deferred prosecution agreement where you don't admit to wrongdoing. But again, as I say in the book, in this chapter called White Collar Crime, if that happens... it's no deterrent, because the amount of money you make from these deals, you know, the fines that you will pay are not enough to stop to change future behavior.
It just becomes operational cost
Correct.
For the banks.
Correct. I think you know, $2 billion in fines sounds like a lot, but it's a few days in revenues for these big banks.
Well, speaking about banking, I do want to bring it back home to Malaysia in terms of the banking system. Yesterday, we heard that Dato' Sri Nazir Razak resigned from CIMB. I'd like to get your thoughts on Nazir's role in all of this.
Well, he, you know, we say in the book how he had helped to funnel UMNO money via CIMB during the 2013 elections. I don't have any evidence or knowledge that Nazir knew anything about where that money was from. We, you know, when we found out about that and asked him about it, he put out a statement to us very quickly saying, you know, admitting it and saying this had happened, but I have no idea whether this money is from 1MDB, and we don't have any knowledge that he knew the money was from there. And I think actually by giving us that statement, he helped confirm about the money, that these documents we had about Najib's accounts were real. So I think people in the Prime Minister's office were actually pretty pissed off at the time that he had done so. And so I have no idea whether his resignation has anything to do with 1MDB. He's certainly not a central player in the whole scandal.
I'd like to spend the last few minutes that we have with you, Tom, on air, addressing questions that we've received this morning. Thank you, everyone, for your questions today. Now, a question from Anonymous on WhatsApp. With Dato' Sri Najib now pending trial, will your book criminalise him in the eyes of the public?
Do you think we should answer questions from anonymous people?
I think this is just a lack of putting a name down.
Oh,
I see.
Okay. Will it criminalize him? You mean, will it prejudice his trial? No, I don't think so. I think good journalism, as I said earlier, it's about writing what you have evidence for. It's about informing. And, you know, there's this idea that, and Jola's lawyers are saying this, is somehow we are prejudicing the trial by our reporting. Well, that's not how democracies work, right? Big, strong, powerful, and independent newspapers are important because they bring to light what happened. And, of course, the judge will make his own decision in former Prime Minister's case. And we, you know, our newspaper coverage of that won't influence in any way, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, Asila's asking on Twitter, we all know the central characters, Jolo, Najib, Rosma. Is there an underrated character within the scandal that we're not talking enough about?
I think Yusuf Al-Otaiba, I mentioned earlier, the United Arab Emirates ambassador to Washington. He's still there. He's a very powerful ambassador. He is he's the Arab ambassador that the Washington types go to sort of tell them about the Middle East. He was really Jolo's gateway to get to know other powerful Middle Eastern investors. And 1MDB was sort of modeled on Mubadala, right? Jolo met the Mubadala CEO through Otaiba. And so, and Otaiba benefited greatly from his role, from his friendship with Jolo, because he was paid, you know, millions of dollars in fees. Whether Otaiba knew where the money was from, I've got no idea, but he's definitely a sort of underrated character, I'd say.
And a tweet by Encik Khaled, how much more material didn't make it into the book, Tom?
Oh, quite a lot. Yeah, we had a whole scene starting with Jolo flying into Mongolia. A whole chapter starting with Jolo flying into Mongolia, where he was doing this deal to buy a coal mine up there, Gobi Coal. And Jolo tries to get a cut, a 15% cut of the deal. There was just so much, so many things. I mean, it's incredible what this character could juggle, and how many different deals that were going on, and he could keep them all the balls in the air. But the problem was, his story is already extremely complicated. And one of the huge problems we had, challenges we had with the book, was trying to streamline it so that people could follow what was happening. You know, and some of the comments on the book have been, well, you know, the Brazen Sky thing is so complicated. We had to keep Brazen Sky because that whole Cayman Islands part is crucial.
Important, yeah.
Right? Whereas something like the Gobi thing, we lost it because it was just like a tangent.
And is a movie deal a part of the plans, Tom?
We are in negotiations with people for a movie deal, yes. And watch this space.
I've been speaking to Tom Wright, co-author of The Billion Dollar Whale. Thank you so much for being on The Breakfast Grill today.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for sending in your questions and comments to the show. I'm Melissa Idris for The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's Mobile Data Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.